This is a Deese World production in association with Pants Pending Studios.
My big sister and I are so excited to introduce our new podcast to you. Trading Pages is a wonderful
podcast. Tradingpages.pantspending.com.
Hold on, I'm not there yet. A podcast where two sisters sit down and talk about their love for surrealist novels, manga,
No. We're talking about romance, meet cutes, daring acts of love.
A new plan. Each week we convene online, despite being 2,500 miles away, to willingly have sibling spats about our taste in books.
Each week, we assign each other a book outside of our comfort zone, and then the next week, we
tear it to shreds.
No, we discuss what we liked, what we didn't like.
Usually that one.
Bronwyn. And then we give each other a new book so we can start all over again. We have a 2-week schedule so listeners can read along if they like.
We are part of the Pants Pending Studios Entertainment Network.
Find Trading Pages at tradingpages.pantspending.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts. Bronwyn, what are you doing?
Hold on. I'm texting Mom to apologize for our content this week. Again.
Oh, no.
Listening to The Social Hour.
They're not PC, so if occasional foul language turns you off, then you have all been warned. This is the calm before the storm.
Oh, listen, I need to show you guys this, and it feels creepy.
Get ready for The Social Hour.
Deese World Studios in Spokane, Washington. This is The Social Hour. On today's show, professor and author of the new book, A Modern Approach to the Birds and the Bees, Robin Pickering. And now your host. He wanted to write a book about sexuality, but international peace treaty agreements don't allow it. Deese Casillas.
Malam Keen, everyone, welcome to the show. This is The Social Hour. I am Deese. Thank you for coming around for another great episode of the show. On the show today, we have author and professor Robin Pickering. Just wrote a new book, A Modern Approach to the Birds and the Bees. We're going to talk to her all about that in just a second. Before we get to that, guys, I need you to go to Deese Comedy /calendar. Check out all the dates on the calendar. I'm moving around again, doing some stuff, man. So check it out. I'll be in Missoula, Montana this 15th with Philip Kopczynski, JJ's Brewing, Jeremiah Johnson Brewing in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho on the 22nd. Shooters in Lewiston on the 23rd, and Flathead Lake Brewing Company on the 24th, as well as some other stuff. If you're in the area where we record this show, Spokane, Washington, every Wednesday I'm hosting trivia at the Spokane Comedy Club. And starting this Tuesday, every Tuesday will be trivia at the Lion's Lair also. So it's like trivia is like the methadone of comedy. So I can't do comedy, but I can be on stage and still be a dick. So come join in the fun, guys. It's something until we get comedy back in Washington State. But as always, this show free twice a week, The Social Minute every Monday also. Share, tell people you like it, give it a like and share, all that good stuff. And if you like what we do, you can donate, you can subscribe on the website, or you can do a one-time donation. You can also go to Deese-Casillas on Venmo and just show some appreciation for what we do. We're bringing this free content to you, as well as sketch comedy and other stuff. And I got a couple projects up my sleeve that I'm working on, batting some stuff around. You'll probably hear some rumblings of it soon, but there's rumor of a second podcast soon. Different. Wildly different. It's going to be about Victorian age queens that were usurped from their thrones by cryptozoological animals. Pretty obscure. But that's what they say. The more specific, the better it is, right? I got an idea. I'm batting it around with some people. So stay tuned. We might have that coming soon. Or maybe not. Either way, right now in studio, a good friend of mine, happy to finally have her on. Very, very interesting, engaging, great interview, guys. Author, professor, Robin Pickering. She just dropped a new book, A Modern Approach to the Birds and the Bees. Go pick it up, give it a read, and listen to the interview. Please welcome Robin Pickering.
Gainfully employed, independently to completely unemployed. So,
yeah.
But although luckily I still get to do, I keep saying that, but I am working and making money and have things I'm doing. It's just what I was doing is dead forever.
Well, I'm glad that we're starting on this super high note.
Yeah. It's just being realistic.
Next, I brought you a card that I'd like you to open in front of me. It's sort of a sympathy card. Sorry you're not employed.
Yeah. This is a slash gift card to Starbucks because you probably need it since you don't have a job.
Figured we'd start there and just see how far lower we could go.
Thank you. I can get pretty low. my life, you have no idea how low I can manage to get good. And still feel comfortable in life, actually.
This is great. So,
Robin, thanks for coming on. I appreciate you being here. We have known each other for a couple of years. I'm glad to finally have you on the show. I'm excited to have you here because you have, first of all, you're well-educated, have a lot of unique and well-educated opinions. a lot of people have opinions in America. But not a lot of people are educated. So I feel like that's a good, your heads and tails above the rest. You also recently released a book called A Modern Approach to the Birds and the Bees, which I got a copy of today. Your agent didn't send me an advance copy, but that's okay. I'm going to read it and I will discuss later. I'm looking forward to reading it. As the aforementioned being unemployed, I've had a lot more time to read, which has been nice. But I'm excited to talk to you about this book. It's something you've been working on for a little while, too.
It is. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Great to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad we could get you on and talk about this and, kind of everything going on right now. It's a crazy, crazy time in America.
I agree. It's a unique time for sure, particularly as someone that works in the health field. It's a pretty exciting, interesting, scary, all of those things time.
Yeah. Well, let's get a little background on you before we dive into the book, because you're a professor. You work in the health field. Let's get a little more detailed, explicit, what do you do?
Yes. Great question. Thank you.
Yes.
I am a professor of the health sciences, and then I am a program director of women and gender studies. So my interest area for the last 18 years has been really looking at the complex nature of health issues and outcomes in this country, and particularly I'm interested in women's health issues.
Sure.
And that has kind of morphed over the years into looking at the impact of different exposures, and over the last probably 8 or 9 years, really looking at sexuality education and the impact of that on different health outcomes.
Okay.
So that's kind of where I'm at right now. And I got pretty excited about that, teaching that the last however many years, and really started noticing that there was a gap between what the research says and what people are learning about in school and in the broader society. So saw a need there, and that's kind of what led me to the book.
Why do you think there was such a gap in between research and education? And 'cause it seems to be, whether not just in this particular field, but it seems to be fact, whether it's history or things like current sciences, there always seems to be a lot lost between the actual information and what gets to the education level.
I would agree.
agree with that. I think it's really interesting. And actually, I got excited about this because as I started to travel more in Europe and in Scandinavian countries, I noticed that the way parents educated kids about sex was completely different from the way that we approach it here in the U.S.
Sure. Maybe not as taboo.
Yeah. I remember a friend telling me... actually, I'm going to retract that story.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, I'm censoring a little bit. I will.
That's
I'll,
all right.
I'll
you can. You can. You
spot.
Cannot. You know. Don't. You don't have to use names and dates. You can. You know. Broad stroke. Or I once heard someone tell me about a guy they knew that.
Okay. I know a friend of a friend of your friend of a friend.
Yeah.
That was getting his hair cut in a salon, I guess you'd call it, in. A European country, and they offered him a beer and a porn mag as he waited for his haircut.
Sure.
And it was considered a very normal thing to be sitting in the lobby. And of course, that struck me. And as I launched into just asking questions, traveling, the approach is just so different in terms of how people even have conversations at the dinner table.
Right.
And, children are expected to grow up fairly quickly in terms of personal responsibility.
Right.
So discussions of birth control, discussions of just individual accountability are very normal from a young age. And intuitively, I think a lot of it, particularly Americans, would think, oh, then they're going to run out and be more promiscuous.
Right. Yeah.
And it's saying that sexuality is okay at a young age. And obviously, that's quite counter to a lot of the messaging that we have, I think, here.
Yeah, sure.
But what was interesting to me is the outcomes are far better when that approach is used.
Right.
So rates of HIV, much lower. STIs in general, much lower. Teen pregnancies, much lower, and unintended pregnancies, much lower. And so then I just started digging a little bit more in many of these places, especially, well, again, a lot of the European countries start sexuality education in schools even at age 4.
Sure.
So kids are learning really young what the parts are called and the actual names of the parts. They're learning how to stay safe. Again, a personal accountability model. And the outcomes are far better in terms of those measures that I just listed.
Well, isn't that kind of what's, you know, in Europe, just for other examples, which is going to tie back into exactly what you're saying, I feel like just their whole model in general of raising children as like the way they treat alcohol, the way, you know, they bring it to the table quite literally and figuratively at an early age, introduce it, teach the personal responsibility you mentioned, and then the rates of alcoholism and alcohol abuse are drastically down in those regions also. You have... Anytime you put like a weird energy around things, like if a kid in America, you grow up in a household where, you know, you're never allowed to have soda. The moment that kid is let off to college, he's going to be just butt-chugging Mountain Dew 24 hours a day.
Are we talking literally, because, or does this represent something else?
You know, I'm just talking about my own experiences.
Okay.
I don't know about
Mountain Dew experimentation.
Right. Yeah,
thank you. This could make a whole different show.
It's sweet of anyone to think I went to college. they just gravitate towards it because it's something that they were just told was bad, or was they have to have, you know, anytime you put a weird energy around something, kids are drawn to it. People have a weird taboo kind of magnetism towards it. Whereas if you kind of educate them, they have a better, you know, they kind of know how to navigate it a little better.
Well, and I think those are two kind of different camps, two different worldviews of, how do we structure things? Do we give people exposure, you know, legalize drugs, legalize a lot of these things? Do we give people exposure to them and then educate them and hope that they will make the best choices? Or the other camp where we focus on regulation and minimizing exposure And
well, I mean, the war on drugs nailed it, so I guess that worked. That worked 100%.
Yeah, it did.
So
we fixed that one.
We totally won there.
We did. That was a definite success. Thank you, Nancy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's more difficult, I think, than just saying people are capable of making all the right choices if you just give them the right information and empower them. Particularly because if we look at some of the socioeconomic differences, some of the environmental differences, not always are people empowered to make the right choices.
Right.
And sometimes people don't have the same access to information. And that was actually one of the barriers, too, in approaching this book, is that not only do kids have different access to accurate information, we see a broad variety of educational exposures in the U.S.
Yeah.
Most people are relying on the school to take care of the sex ed piece, but particularly in conservative states and in different places where people maybe don't have qualified instructors, maybe that aren't given the right resources for education, when people are inhibited by, you know, different school boards have different ideas about what should be taught in school.
Sure. Yeah.
Not everybody's getting the same access to the same education. And then particularly when you couple that with, you know, parents that might not be informed or not be comfortable having those conversations, where then are kids getting that information? And of course, now that pretty much everybody has access to the internet, kids are searching, you know, porn and porn sites and
wait, they have porn on the internet?
I've heard that.
Okay.
Well, I heard it from you.
Yeah. It's just my browser history is all.
But since so many kids have all of this access now, it's not that they're not asking the questions. They're asking the questions. It's just that now they're getting their questions answered by maybe less than reputable sources.
Sure. You're telling me YouPorn isn't the best way for them to figure out?
Well, it probably depends on the question.
Yeah. what is your safe word? Now, let's figure that out on YouPorn. No, yeah, I mean, there's a couple failings here, and I think part of it is our education system, the aforementioned education system. The family unit has really almost entirely dissolved in America in so many ways, where and that has to do with a couple different things also, depending on where you're at. It has to do with the economy and the amount of work families have to do, as well as I think other factors like social media and stuff has completely disconnected people from other people. But yeah, some personal responsibility, you know, if you start with family and education, I think that fixes a ton of problems in America, you know, and really can help focus people getting that early education. And then that can become broader in school at younger ages. And also it's less taboo because your parents have introduced it to you, things like that.
Yeah, and I think you touch on a couple assumptions there, and I think some people would say, okay, we just need more access to education. Well, I think we have to go further than that and look at what the education is.
Sure, yeah.
So if we have a model where, okay, you're the only male teacher at the elementary school, so now you're the one that's going to be in charge of the boy room and answering all the boy questions.
Yeah.
And if we aren't giving teachers the tools that they need to deliver this sort of content, you know, it's not the same as delivering math content.
Yeah,
it does require a certain
some nuance
knowledge,
or...
yeah, and some nuance and some ability to kind of reach people where they're at. Additionally, I think we need to be more open to, as you mentioned, educating at a young age. So we're currently having a lot of push and pull politically in terms of when we should start sex ed in the schools.
Yeah.
And traditionally it's been, in our area, it's been about fourth or fifth grade.
Is it really that at that age now?
It has been traditionally.
Oh,
and
wow.
Now we just passed legislation that is saying, okay, we can start younger, and in fact, as early as kindergarten.
I honestly would have assumed it was older, because I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember it, but I am obviously older than yeah. I don't remember it until about junior high school, I believe.
Well, and I think that you're making the point that oftentimes people will have it early, but it will just be HIV/AIDS education, or it'll be, mm-hmm. hey, you're going to get hair in your armpits, and you should probably shower every day. And if you missed school that day, well, then now you don't know about the hair and you don't know about the showering.
Sure, yeah.
And you
Catch
just have up. To wait until next year to find that out. But I think you highlight something important, that we talk about math nearly every day. We talk about English. We talk about all these things. But we generally reserve a really small portion of the curriculum to educating about something that, in my opinion, is very important. And in the absence of a quality sexuality education, quality education at home, I think kids are at a real disadvantage mm-hmm. in terms of just being equipped to handle the world that we live in now.
Yeah. So you mentioned that they've voted to start teaching sex ed as early as kindergarten now in our area. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's a little bit complicated. I don't know how much time you want to spend on this, but there's currently a proposal for a referendum that maybe you're hearing about. Spokane has made some protections in terms of what we've decided to do, but in terms of Washington State, we do have a fairly large collective of folks who are pushing to remove that decision that was made, so that kids aren't exposed to sexuality education as young. And there's a ton of misinformation. You know, I've seen everything from they're going to be showing porn to kindergartners.
Sure, yeah.
When in reality, what we're teaching young people at those ages in terms of age-appropriate content, it's here's what your body parts are actually called. Here's how you stay safe. And what we're seeing is when kids are able to say, this isn't my cookie or my pee-pee or whatever, but this is my, you know, whatever the part is, and this is somebody touched this or somebody did this, that we're actually arming children with the tools that they need to help protect them. And so the resistance to that, I think it's right for us to be worried for our kids. I think we're directing our efforts, at least some are directing their efforts at the wrong thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's such an interesting age, because now with the advent of the internet, there is no, I understand some of these parents where they're coming from to a point, but there is no innocence anymore. Everything is available. Everything is available and have access to it all the time. You're far better off educating these children at an early age with an actual kind of structured education system that has some reality based in it and some ideas that really work for kids, instead of them just being like, just throwing shit into Google, like you said, and kind of figuring, you know, running it up against crazy websites or misinformation or just stuff that they're maybe not ready for. I mean, you can kind of edge them into this to prepare them for everything.
I agree. And it's not as if what I'm talking about is only just a kid sitting alone in the basement when his parents go to the store and Googling all these terms. In reality, kids are exposed to sexuality education every day. If you turn on the news and hear about sexual assault happening,
sure, which is a lot recently,
yeah.
very prevalent.
When we talk about all these issues surrounding consent and grabbing people and places, and it's not that people are only exposed to sexual content from private Google searches. And in fact, what we're finding now, too, when young people are being exposed to sexual content, it's oftentimes people sending them pictures from school, or people sending them things that they didn't even ask for, or turning on the news and just hearing, you know, the Me Too stories and these different things. We're exposed to a lot of content that is helping them form ideas about things. And my opinion is that if we accept that that's the reality we live in, and I can understand why that is hard to accept, but if we can accept that those are the exposures that they're going to get, can't we instead give them a safe place to ask questions, create an open environment where they can talk to their parents about this stuff, or talk to a trusted peer or adult or teacher or counselor? Because unless you're raising them in a bubble, it's just not the reality.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's important to understand is that and I think that's one of the hardest things for some of the older generations to kind of understand is that things have changed. This is the new reality. I know there's this idealistic Pleasantville you want to maybe still live in that never really existed anyway, because you know, just everyone was just racist with an alcohol problem and beat their wives. Like, wasn't really better, you know. Like, so that doesn't exist. This is the reality we live in. We kind of have to take reality on reality's terms. So how do we massage this version of the reality to help educate and best navigate it for our generation's future, you know, and not just kind of, because we can hide behind things, but they're still, like you said, they're still going to be exposed in unintentionally or unwillingly at times. So there's no way around that unless you're just putting your kid in a underground bunker for the until they're 18.
And I think it's important too to look at, hopefully, a good sexuality education, a good open communication with family members about expectations can serve them far beyond that. So I've had several people, another area of interest of mine is looking at what does the post-Me Too world look like for men and for women in the workplace? And mm-hmm. one of the things that I have had a lot recently are people reaching out saying, after this whole Me Too thing, I don't know how I'm supposed to act at work. I don't know, can I give women hugs? Do I not give them hugs? Can I go out for drinks after work with women, or is that taboo now? There's even literature that supports the fact that people are just starting to say, you know what, maybe it's easier if I just don't hire women, or maybe it's easier if I just don't invite them to these things right. so that I don't get in trouble. Where I think a better solution is to, what if we grow a whole new generation of people that understand what consent looks
that
like?
Crazy, what a crazy concept. What if instead, get out of here, Riley. You and your education. Get out of here with that bullshit. First of all, we'd have to agree on something. That's impossible.
Yeah, there we go. But this idea of, hey, what if we just, instead of just avoiding people or avoiding situations that, you know, allegedly might get us in trouble, why don't we just get better at dealing with men and women and girls and boys and children and adults and kind of develop those skills. So I'm just really in support of starting those conversations early about consent and what healthy relationships can look like. And I think that there could be some really long-term positive consequences if we use that approach from an early age.
Yeah, I agree 100%. It's something that, you know, early and often for anything is always better if you want to be, you know, embedded and ingrained in it. I think for the people who ask those questions that you mentioned, like, can I hug this person? Can I invite them out? Like, if you're asking the question, it's probably a no. I don't know. There's people I know that I hug when I see, and like, I know that's okay. Like, I know they feel, although I hugged you when you got here, maybe that wasn't okay. But I feel like
I was going to talk to you about that. Yeah, I was going to do it off camera here.
But like, people I know who were close friends or family and I hugged them. Then there's people who there's times when like, I'm on the fence, or they've asked me, or I've asked them. If they're people, when I do comedy, like if I'm at shows, if we're strangers, like, and we're taking pictures, I don't touch those people. I stand next to them if they want to take a picture, but like, I'm not going to put my arm around them. I'm not going to, if they, you know, put their arm around me, okay, we're doing a different thing now. But like, otherwise we're just, just kind of learn boundaries with people. And I don't think it's that difficult. I think people just want to make it difficult so they have something to kind of complain about, or, you know?
Yeah, I think, and I won't get on a soapbox here about the need to want to be oppressed, but to claim oppression, I think that it really isn't difficult at all. And I think the magic answer is just ask. Hey, can I hug you?
Yeah.
Hey, can I hold your hand? I think that once that becomes normalized, we realize it's really not that difficult. I had a male friend who was, I guess, bothered by the culture that has developed in the professional world post-Me Too, as he saw it. And what he let me know is that he just waits now. If there's a meeting and there's only women in the conference room, he'll wait outside the door until another man comes in so that he can't be accused. These are his words. So that I can't be accused of sexual harassment. And so I thought, wow, let's unpack that one. One, are you so afraid of what you might do that you need a witness? Or two, are you so afraid of the perception of wrongdoing,
right,
that you feel like you can't even be in the same room as a woman? And I think whichever one of those is true, that tells us that we need to work on something here.
Yeah.
And maybe it's shades of both of those things. It tells me we need to work on consent and figuring out what's appropriate in the workplace. And two, is there a gap between perception of wrongdoing and actual wrongdoing? And I think all of those types of conversations would be easier if we came from a stronger base of education.
Yeah. Now, question on that. I want to make sure I heard you correctly. Was he talking about like a meeting room with an individual woman or multiple women? There's just no other men in there yet.
Multiple women. Okay. There's no other men. And
that that seems weird to me. The one-on-one, I could kind of see it a little bit. That's a different story. Multiple women. Now you're just assuming an entire group of people in an office is willing to. Let's go with the narrative that there was no wrongdoing, but everyone in this room, because they're not a man, is going to get on board and fabricate
it's like
this story.
Salem witch trial
where you've done something wrong,
for this moment,
right? Yeah, like this. That seems a little wild to me. You have to get everyone on board there. You know, like that seems unscrupulous and nefarious in an odd way that doesn't exist. One-on-one, depending on my relationship with that person, like in that office, like there's plenty of women. I've like, no problem. There's some people like, and it's not even necessarily for me when I encounter situations like that where I don't, where I'm worried about what they may, what I could potentially say that would offend them or something like that. For me, it's more like, maybe they just be more comfortable, like without like, even like, I live in a world where I understand that like a man can be threatening to a woman. Like Amanda Nunes would beat the shit out of me, but like, you know, but like,
do you need somebody to be in the room with you?
Yes. With Amanda Nunes. I don't know. I might like it. But you know, like I get that, you know, like I was out, lime scootering around with a friend of mine the other night. And, you know, I'm telling her, I'm like, yeah, I just go out late at night. Like I'll go out and just run around downtown, like run down train tracks and, you know, taking pictures and this, that's like 1 a.m. and like, it's great. And I'm like, and then the stuff, I'm like, I realize that's probably not as easy for you. Like it's a different story for her to do that. You know, that's the world we live in. I think we can all accept that. So, I have those perceptions in certain circumstances when I'm with, an individual woman I don't know, where I'm like, I just want to make them feel comfortable. Like, you know, so I don't want to be like, hey, let's go in this, like, we're in this room, and then I close the door. It's just, or, you know, whatever.
It's, I think it's hard for people to see a reality that doesn't match their own. You know, it's hard to see American privilege when you are an American. It's hard to see male privilege when you're a male. It's hard to see a lot of these things.
White and privilege when, yeah. Let's just say it. Come on.
I didn't know how deep you wanted to go on this.
Oh, wait, come on. We go as deep as we have to go. You've seen the shit I post and talk about, Robin. This is not.
But it's hard to see those, and it doesn't necessarily make us the bad guy. It's not the reality that we're used to seeing.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I hear people say, well, now I feel like I have to watch everything I say because of this Me Too thing or because of, you know, whatever. I think of, and this was actually an idea for a book that I was going to have that I probably shouldn't even mention just in case I decide to do it.
Yeah.
But when I heard people say, oh, well, now I just feel like I'm just constantly having to think about, should I not go in the conference room yet? And then I thought about, I wonder how many times per day women think about their personal safety. You know, and then I started to think, okay, when I walk out to the car, am I carrying my keys a certain way?
Right.
When I walk by a certain group of people where I could see a potential for catcalling, am I shifting my bag in a different way so that I'm more covered? When I, you know, go to a meeting, am I being called kiddo or sweetheart, you know, by a male colleague who is my age? And I just think about the average woman, how many times a day she's thinking about her femaleness compared to now are we asking people to just think about their maleness a few times.
Yeah.
And it's hard to see a reality that isn't yours, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that we're asking a population of people to think about their maleness.
Yeah, I think it's important to be, and I think that's kind of, thank you for eloquently kind of stating what I was kind of attempting to say ham-handedly, but I mean, it's important to be cognizant of who you are and what you are in situations and be aware of other people and their feelings in those situations too. And it's not always with, you know, it doesn't always necessarily have to be with the opposite sex. I mean, there's other versions of that same reality where it's like, I just need to be cognizant of like my space, what I'm saying, how, you know, everything like that. I mean, and it's funny, like you say, like, it just made me think like, you know, carrying your keys to the car. I'm like, every woman I know has mace on their keychain when they go to the, like, when they go to buy eggs at the store. Like, the only time men carry mace is, like, when they think they're going to be attacked by a bear in the woods. So, like, there is a disparity in the feeling of, you know, just general safety and overall how things, kind of our population, operates with each other.
Yeah, and I think it's important, too, and this might rub some of my fellow feminist friends the wrong way, but in my opinion, I think meeting people where they are at in that journey of learning and trying to be effective in those conversations is more important than saying, you know, I think when people hear that I'm a feminist and a, you know, a professor in women and gender studies and those things, they instantly are on the defensive of, oh gosh, she's going to start preaching at us about whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to apologize for being male. And I think it's important for us to not approach it that way, but to just meet people where they're at, accept that they just oftentimes have different experiences, mm-hmm. and it doesn't make you a predator because you haven't experienced those things. It doesn't make you a bad person that you don't know what it is like to experience femaleness if you're not female. And I think sometimes we have to have some grace with each other and meet each other where we're at and come at a place of education and empathy and listening to stories versus attacking in a way that just makes people go on the defensive. So I think, and it ties into a lot of these things that I was speaking of earlier, that if we can get better at these conversations, get more open with these conversations, we can be more productive and not be so defensive or even uneducated.
Well, I think that's a really important conversation. The openness and like kind of, you know, meeting people where they're at is something that is very important and not done enough anymore. Recently, last week, I kind of had a socio-political disagreement with another gentleman online. And we kind of debated for a minute. It wasn't super cordial. But I try to be like, you know, I don't sling insults or want to be rude. I just kind of want to be poignant and a little sharp, and biting is kind of what I do. And we kind of, as the conversation progressed, we realized there were some things on the issue we also agreed about. So we like, you know, I moved the conversation to direct message. We kind of talked for a minute, and then we decided to meet up and have coffee last week. And we talked for like 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
And it was really... Because I just remember, you know, it just, I try to remember that these other people, especially online when you engage with people, they're actually other people and they're humans, you know, and it's very easy to, you know, just type words on your computer and throw it into a box and off it goes into the internet to some faceless, you know, other profile. Whereas you stop and you sit down and have a conversation with these people, at the very base level, we're all human. And that's a good starting point. And then we can kind of have a conversation from there about what we agree with, what we don't, why that is. And you can kind of start to learn from each other. But if you never get that, even willing to have that experience, and you know, you may walk away and be like, well, no, we didn't make any headway. But, you know, oftentimes I think you'd find that there is a lot of shared experiences and education anyone can get from each other, you know?
I think you make a really good point there. And I for whatever reason, maybe I'll respond with two things there. One, I often think of, would this person shovel my driveway if I were stuck in the snow?
Yeah.
And some of the people who are as far as possible on the other political or other side of the political spectrum from me, I have every bit of me believes that if I were snowed in on a snowy day or stuck on the side of the road, that they'd be the first ones out there shoveling me out. And because I know those people, people are my extended family.
Yeah.
They're conservatives. They're farmers. They would do anything possible for a neighbor that needed them. And so sometimes I struggle with, I'm not going to cancel those people. I'm not going to not listen to those people. Those are my family. Those are the types of people that I know face to face have a kind heart.
Right.
We just disagree on how we should go about reaching certain goals. And as you mentioned, a lot of those goals are the same. So like when I look, the topic of sexuality has so much emotional sort of baggage with it and so much shame attached to it and so many things that trigger different things in different people. But at the end of the day, most all of us want exactly the same thing. We want our kids to be healthy. We want our kids to be safe from predators. We want our kids to, if they choose to reproduce, to do it when they want to and are ready to.
Yeah.
All of those things across the board, I think all people want there to be fewer or no abortions. I mean, nobody is wanting more of those things. So
right.
If we can agree that those are all the same things that we want and that we just maybe go about it differently in terms of how we get there, I think productive conversations can start with that. Do we agree that those are the outcomes that we are looking for? And now, are we willing to be open to what the research says will help us get there?
Yeah.
And from what I have experienced in the research, what helps us to reach those goals are early education, are open, honest conversations in the household, are a public willingness to talk about these things more than just one day a semester, and if you're not there that day, then you miss it.
Tough shit, yeah.
And being open about exposures on the internet and being able to talk about those things. So my goal as a professional is to say, hey, if we can all agree that those are the goals we're reaching towards, what can I do to get that information out there and open up people to those conversations, even though they are oftentimes uncomfortable for people?
Yeah, I mean, because if you're not willing to have those conversations, you know, early and often is the best time. But even ever, you know, now people are so in just staunchly rigid and engulfed in their individual camps and echo chambers that they're not willing to even have a conversation with anyone that deviates from their ideals slightly. And this puts everyone in these boxes and disassociates people and doesn't allow for any movement. And no one wants to budge an inch from where they are. And it's like, if you're not even willing to have this conversation with these people, there's no opportunity to even build a bridge. You know, and as I was talking about this with some people the other day in my experience with this guy I had coffee with, you know, someone's like, well, you know, there's some deal breakers for me. Like, you know, I don't need any racists in my life. And I'm like, I get that. I'm like, I don't want any racists in my life either. But, also, if you never are willing to have a conversation with that racist, that person, you're never giving them an opportunity or attempting to maybe educate them in a way where maybe they change their tune. Maybe you talking to them is what starts them down the path of no longer having those feelings. And a lot of people don't necessarily... a lot of people aren't exposed to certain things throughout their life too, which, you know, at a certain point, not that, you know, for an extreme example, some kid who's just raised in the backwoods of Alabama, like Deliverance style, and like, you know, only had like this little town he lived in, and it was all old white racist people, and like, and was never exposed to anything else, and it was just entrenched in that education. Well, if that kid grows up racist, like, it's kind of not his fault, you know? He just didn't have an opportunity to have exposure to anything else. So do we just relegate him away from society, or do we ever offer him an opportunity to change his mind?
I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, as a college professor, I encounter that nearly every day where most of the students that I encounter have all of their parents' political ideologies, all of their parents' perspectives on all of these things. And they are, for the first time, being open to a variety of ideas about things that are maybe, not always, but maybe challenging some of the things that they grew up with. And for me, it's really exciting to watch those wheels kind of spin of, wait a second, this is challenging some of the things that some of these dogmatic ideas that I've just never questioned. And as we hopefully develop skills for critical thinking and give people access to different perspectives, I get to watch every day those things happening. And I think I can understand why it feels really good to just limit our exposures to people that already agree with us.
Yeah.
Because it's easy. I don't have to do any extra work. I don't have to get angry. I don't have to get annoyed. I don't have to come up with new strategies of explaining my perspectives because everyone's already on board.
Right.
You know, and I can understand why sometimes that's even necessary because it can be draining to just be challenged all the time. But I also think it's fairly intellectually lazy.
Absolutely.
Because it requires no work. Mm-hmm. So I think just as you mentioned, I try to view opportunities like that when there's a pushback of, okay, this is going to make me work. This is going to make me come up with new reasons to express why I think the way that I do or why I think policies should look the way that they should. But it also requires a skill set that I think a lot of us are lacking in, and that's how do we engage in civil discourse?
Yeah.
And I think it's super easy when we just cancel everybody and when we just unfriend everybody, because then we don't have to do civil discourse. But I would challenge us just as a nation, as a body, as a as a whatever, as humanity, to instead of just closing those doors, to instead reframe and work on how do we get better at civil discourse?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, actually having that conversation, which is, you know, almost obsolete now, it seems, and giving people an opportunity to grow and learn is important also, which I don't think we do. We just, as you said, we just cancel people and then that's it. You know, we don't, there's no opportunity to, you know, I mean, like, God, if we're talking people like Epstein or something, like, there's not a lot of growth or whatever, you know, but like there's opportunities where people have made mistakes or past mistakes. But I mean, it's part of the reason, like, I always say, like, I don't have ideals in life. I just have ideas. Because people have ideals are like dogmatically, staunchly rigid, and they never bend no matter what information comes their way. Like, I have ideas that are current ideas. They're very malleable and I'm very willing to let them be evolved over time as the climate changes and things in this world change and I gain more education. You know, like when I was a kid, is calling someone retarded as like not as kind of like, oh, that, or say like if something wasn't like, oh, that movie was retarded if you didn't like it, you know, very prevalent when we were younger.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, obviously, very socially unacceptable. And I get that. I totally understand it. And I don't use that phrase anymore. The retroactive canceling because people were like, is like that, this weird retroactive punitive punishment of like, hey, that person, it was of the time. If they're evolving and changing with society to keep up with what we're consider acceptable now, like, I think that's what we should be kind of the.
It's such a self-righteous perspective to say, okay, you said this one thing once 15 years ago. I now denounce you.
Yeah.
Because I have yet to make any errors in judgment. I have yet to make any mistakes.
Right.
I think of all the ridiculous things that I've said and done and think, man, if somebody was following me around with a recorder.
Oh, my God.
And I even tried to get a job in academia. They'd say, oh, gosh, like, no. You know, I'm a women and genders studies program director. And I think back to when I first got into teaching, what I even thought being a feminist meant.
Sure.
And I did not even describe myself with that title because I had this view of what feminists were as these sort of fringe people that had, you know, they hated men and were all, and that's such an ignorant stance. I just didn't know any better then.
Yeah.
And I think we are called to, when we know better, to do better. But the assumption that we are born knowing better, or
right,
that at any point in our even personal histories that we just knew it all, I just think is a really self-righteous approach. And if we can accept the humanity in ourselves, we can sort of accept that in other people. I think we value, in, you know, every election season, I see people saying things like, well, you know, we can count on him because he's in 20 years has voted exactly the same way,
yeah,
on this issue. And he's not wishy-washy like such and such. And I think, man, I hope my opinions about things change in the next 20
yeah,
years.
Yeah, things
like,
change a lot.
I'm not going to wear that as a badge that I've never changed my mind about anything in 20 years.
yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, I think about that, just some of the ridiculous things. And, you know, in the book I write about Revenge of the Nerds. I don't know if you ever saw
it.
Oh,
yeah.
So
yeah.
That was just sort of like a really popular movie when I was young. And I watched it not too long ago. And I'm thinking of the scene where they're at the fair or whatever it is. And he basically has that costume on and ends up having sex with the sorority girl that he had the crush on.
Yeah.
Disguised as her boyfriend.
Right.
And I'm thinking, okay, that was rape.
Yeah.
That was absolutely rape. And we're all cheering him on,
yeah,
at
that's
that
just
time. Like, hey, the good guy won.
Sure.
You know, the good guy really just showed this sorority girl. And I look back and I think, oh my gosh, like, I was rooting for him then.
Right.
And to think of, what we know, what I know now about consent and about those sort of things, I'm in a different place. And if I can accept that I've grown, can't I accept that other people can grow and change as well with new information? And I hope that's true. And I think that if we just, again, starting with practicing at home, practicing at school, can't we just get better at meeting people where they're at?
Yeah.
Better at educating, better at civil discourse, and stop being so self-righteous about things and
right.
and just throwing people aside.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember, we're about the same age. I remember when...
I'm probably a lot younger, but
I mean,
continue.
Yeah, yeah. I just wanted to make myself feel better. When I was younger, the stigma around even being gay and you even go back to 10 years ago, even as early as 10 years ago, I bet less than half of Democrats were pro gay marriage that are in the Senate or Congress, like the elected officials on Democratic elected officials, probably less than half of them were pro gay marriage. Now, 110% of them are pro gay marriage. So things change, you know, and they can change very quickly. So those things were, not prevalent, or people were against it. Probably 20 years ago, almost every elected official was probably against gay marriage still, and how quickly those things, maybe not quickly enough, but those things change and they evolve. So, even Barack Obama in 2005 was or six was against gay marriage, voted against. So it's is he wrong now? Do we cancel him now? Because back then, his view evolved. He changed his stance to the correct ideas moving forward. So we can't really retroactively penalize people for. I think the only real time we should be able to penalize people is when they're not evolving, when they're not willing to progress.
I think that's a great point. And I think we've gotten really good at weaponizing that growth, either to show that somebody's wishy-washy.
Yeah.
Or, you say you're progressive. Look what you said in 1987 at that birthday party.
Right.
I think, again, it's a self-righteous approach. I think it's really not accepting the full humanity that we hopefully grow and change and are not perfect creatures. And that's, I think, especially, election time, when we're looking to elect a new president or new senators or representatives, when we unearth, single decisions that they made that were... maybe not their finest hour. We're never going to find perfect humans.
Right.
We're just not made that way. And especially now that we have so much data on everybody.
Yeah, right.
it makes it so easy to do, and it's not going to get any better. I'll be honest, I've thought about politics, and I also thought, no, there's just too much data out there.
Yeah.
I'm going to shift my focus. So, yeah, we can really weaponize that information.
Sure.
And I think it impedes progress.
Yeah, well, believe me, I'm running for mayor of Spokane, so this could all be I'm either just going to have to erase everything I've ever done online, my whole identity, or just accept it.
Maybe it'll be, what was that movie where everybody forgot that the Beatles existed?
Oh, Yesterday.
Yeah. Maybe it'll be everybody forgot Dees existed. Just a complete wipeout. And you can start fresh.
Maybe. It won't be the same then. Part of it is who I am. So, yeah, that's a whole other. I am diving headfirst into the transparency. That's kind of my thing.
Well, I think that's where we need to start. I think if we can get over the fact that nobody's going to be perfect except for Barack Obama,
right.
that we can give each other a little bit of grace and recognize that we've hopefully all grown over the years.
Yeah. So, ideally, that's the idea, right? Keep growing. So we've talked about a lot of things. Let's talk about the book specifically. This book, again, the book, Modern Approach to the Birds and the Bees by Robin Pickering. Tell us what, I mean, you touched on it earlier, but, you know, give us a little bit of information about the book.
Yeah. The book basically is meant to be a guide for parents. What I found as I dove into this topic were that the parents that were having conversations about sexuality with their kids, if they had them at all, it was two conversations. One, you're going to get a period or you're going to go through puberty. And two, don't have sex. And those are basically the two birds and the bees talks
sure.
that kids got. And then it's like, please never ask me about this again.
Right.
And good talk, you know.
Make me a highball.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up.
So those were the two conversations, if they happened at all. And then a lot of parents were saying, I'll just count on the school to take care of the rest.
Yeah.
But as I said before, there was limitations about that. And also, not always were the kids, or on top of that, especially now with COVID, there is a lot of unsupervised internet time now.
Yeah. Oh,
and,
sure.
And particularly, a lot of kids are homeschooled now. So even if they were getting some sex ed, for a lot of kids, that's completely wiped out now. And so now parents are having to be in charge of more of these conversations. So not only are kids exposed to more technology, exposed to much easier access to pornography and other things, they're also sometimes not getting it at school. And probably having unsupervised time like they've never had before.
Right.
So what this book is it's, hey, you want to start having these conversations with your kids, or at least can see that it's necessary. Let's start by educating you about, here's what the parts are called. Here's what safe sex looks like. Here's what consent looks like in a modern day. Here's how you do consent. Here's what healthy relationships look like. You know, some kids just don't have access to healthy relationships. You know, maybe they don't
definitely.
See that at home, or maybe there just isn't a romantic relationship at home, and they just don't see what a healthy relationship looks like. So there is information about how do you recognize an unhealthy relationship, and things like breakups. You know, kids are reporting higher levels really than ever before of depression, anxiety, things like that. And so sometimes breakups can be really, really difficult for kids on top of all the other things that are going on. So how do you help a kid that's dealing with a breakup?
Sure.
And so it goes through all of those different chapters, talks a little bit about safe sex, how to stay safe, talks a little bit about different forms of birth control. It also talks about LGBTQ plus populations, because they are often left out of all curriculum.
Yeah, sure.
And they actually are having higher levels of anxiety, depression, even suicide, violence.
Sure.
So the book aims to make up for some of those gaps, too, when schools really aren't doing a great job of reaching out to those kids. When you have just a pregnancy prevention sexual ed curriculum, that pretty much doesn't apply to a huge chunk of what those kids want to know about. And basically this will help to keep all kids safe and not just certain kids safe. So the book goes through each of those chapters and explores those content areas. And then I think one of my favorite parts of the book is a breakdown of basically age by age of what should you be talking about with your kid, all the way from age 4 up through college age of, hey, what does a 4 to 6 year old need to know about their body and keeping safe?
Yeah.
What does a junior high kid need to know about sexting and the law? And what do you do if somebody sends you a picture? And do you tell somebody? Do you show somebody? What happens if you show somebody? So it basically takes a look at just year by year of what kids need to know, how can you start those conversations, and it just serves as a guide throughout all of your children's stages of development.
Yeah. What an interesting landscape, because how things have changed in the last, you know, I couldn't imagine being a youth in what it's like dating and how kind of, you know, the sexual landscape has progressed, the ability to communicate, send pictures, you know, explicit pictures, videos, things like that. I mean, things like that didn't exist when I, you know, it's like what an interesting landscape and how challenging that must be. So, yeah, and kind of like we talked about earlier, that's got to be so challenging for parents given a multitude of things. I think we just have a lot of, you know, the family unit's kind of broken up a lot in America. It's a different landscape. Parents are just forced to work so much due to the economy or the lack of economy that being a parent, you kind of have to choose. Like, can I provide food and shelter? Or, you know, be a full-time parent, you really comes down to that, that choice where you just kind of don't have the time almost. You're just trying to make sure everyone survives.
Right.
You know?
And when you come from an environment where, like you said, you don't even really remember any sex ed. And, you know, I do this every year with my students. I have them raise their hand. Hey, how many of you had a birds and bees discussion with your parents?
Oh, I never, never.
And
we were Catholic, like I said. So we didn't talk about that shit.
Oh, I'll resist all the things that I want to say.
No,
right,
just
now.
Say it. Don't. Why? Well, if you get in trouble, but otherwise.
No, but and now I'm so excited about all the things that I wanted to say that I forgot what I was actually going to say.
Birds and the bees talk.
Yes. So, if there's so few discussions, and if most of us as, you know, parent age people don't remember having a solid, maybe solid conversations with our families about it, barely remember sex ed. Plus, we're raised watching all these movies where, you know, sexual assault, rape, all these things is basically normalized.
Yeah.
It was a pre-Me Too world. So issues around consent look different. Issues around the way in which we just gender roles and all of those things. And now we're supposed to be the ones in charge of educating our kids.
Right.
Who now live in this world where, you know, sexting is a very common thing. Online dating is a very common thing. Revenge porn, things like this, very common. How are we to be equipped with that sort of new role of parenting?
Yeah.
And then to throw on top of that COVID and working multiple jobs and all of these things. So my aim with the book was, how can I make it easier for parents to enter that space when they're really likely coming from an ill-equipped perspective already? So it's really just designed to make those conversations easier with the assumption that they probably just don't have a big background in this stuff. And if you just go online and Google, hey, what do I need to know about sex? You might not encounter the best information.
Sure. Hey, wait, you mean the internet isn't full of the best information always?
And to say, hey, what do I do about sexting? And,
yeah.
And to do, you know, sexting in kids, I just wouldn't recommend just diving into the internet
Yeah, unless you want Chris Hansen showing up at a dinner.
Totally. So this is designed to bypass all those potential pitfalls and make it a little easier for parents who are already probably struggling with a million things.
Yeah.
And likely aren't that excited about having these conversations.
Well, for every parent out there, then they should definitely get the book, because if you are, you probably are too busy and already stressed. So this is just a how-to guide to make sure you have the right conversations with your kids and ideally put them on the right path to, you know, get them where they need to be. So,
I agree. And even if you just haven't had the greatest exposure in your life to sex ed and maybe you work with young people, or you have grandkids, or you just want to know more, I think it doesn't necessarily have to just be for parents.
Yeah. So I have a couple questions for you that don't relate to the book, but do relate to your profession.
Okay, great.
The first one has to do with, are we allowed to talk about where you work, where you teach?
Sure.
I won't name it.
Okay.
It is a Christian, you know, or college.
Absolutely.
Christian university.
Yes.
How is it, and you kind of touched on it earlier a little bit, but, you know, teaching sex ed, feminism, from a woman teacher who is liberal at what I consider Christian. When you think Christian, you think conservative. So... Or I assume most people do, you know.
I think it's fair that probably a lot of people would have that perspective.
What are there obstacles, and how does that, you know, what? Yeah, tell us about that. Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting juxtaposition. I always found that fascinating about what you did, where you did it, because of, you know, my perspective of what a Christian university would be.
I'm so glad you asked that question, and I hope I can do it justice. I think all of those things that you just said are true. I remember when I first started teaching, so prior to teaching where I teach now, I was at two different state institutions, one being in Idaho,
okay,
one being in Washington.
Yeah, very different. Also different challenges.
Yeah, and in both, I, you know, taught coursework in sexuality and sex and society, things like that. And I felt fairly free at that time to just dive into these discussions. Mm-hmm. And when I started working at a Christian institution, I, to be real honest, was quite fearful of, oh my gosh, what kind of pushback am I going to get
from
having these conversations? I was frankly a little surprised that they wanted me anyway, given that just the background, you know, all the things that you just said.
Sure.
So I really came at it from a, like, I was sort of walking on eggshells and, you know, steering the conversation. But the really interesting thing that happened was the entire time that I taught at state institutions, I had to get really good at removing religious conversations from sexuality discussions. And that's hard to do, particularly when you have students who identify as Christian or Catholic or whatever. It was really difficult for me to pull that out. And I remember I had a panel once come to my class, and it was all people who identified as gay or were transgendered. Mm-hmm. And it was just sort of a question and answer. They talked about their coming out process. They talked about those things. And I was continuously trying to navigate away from any, because I had a student that raised their hand and said, well, you know that you're going to hell, right? I thought, oh, I forgot to prep my students for this panel. And I'm just thinking, how do I manage this? And I had a lot of...
How did you handle that situation?
Oh, probably not well at that point. And I even had a student who later came to my office to let me know, well, I just wanted you to know that I'm praying for you because I'm afraid you're going to go to hell for the things that you talk about. And I was so caught off guard and, you know, was a fairly new teacher that I just, okay, well... Are there any questions you have about the exam that I can help you with?
Yeah.
Anything lighter that we could talk about? And, you know, I was a new professor and just didn't handle things, I'm sure, as I should.
Well, it's a learning process. And curve it's a little different than
and
other.
And just when people throw you, you know, things you're not expecting.
Yeah, telling you you're being damned to hell for eternity. That's what, you know, you're not expecting that always, you know.
It was a heavy morning. I was feeling weird about our 8 a.m. class. But... As I, you know, this is the 18th year that I've been teaching now, and so I've hopefully gotten better at it. But as I started teaching at a Christian institution, there, and I will hand it to the institution that I work for, they took a chance on me. They were open to saying, hey, we're interested in having these real conversations. And so I came from a place of having to limit the scope to to just sex, let's not talk about religion, let's not talk about that, to a place where now I can actually talk about the full spectrum of humanity, the full spectrum of sexuality, and how does it fit with your faith?
Yeah.
How does this perspective fit with, your faith journey? And it's actually, and this will sound like I'm, trying to sell something.
Maybe a book.
Actually, the book doesn't really go there.
Okay.
I promise I'm not trying to sell anything other than that book. And this is not what I'm talking about now. But I have been so pleasantly surprised with how open I've been able to be in diving into these conversations in ways that are real. And it's not a Pollyanna thing to say there's been no pushback. I haven't had any problems and everyone's been totally open.
Yeah.
But I've been continuously impressed with the ability of students to be mature about these real conversations and about the openness of the university to say, you know what, we're willing to have hard conversations. And just as we were talking about before, we just need to get better at civil discourse.
Yeah.
And like I continuously tell students, if college isn't a safe place for you to practice civil discourse in a safe environment, I don't know what hope we have beyond that if we can't engage in those real conversations. And just, today, I in my class that I taught this morning, we were just talking about how the language that we use to describe sex acts and sexual anatomy shapes the way in which we see our bodies, shapes the way in which we see sexuality. And, what do those words sound like? How do those words make us feel? And you can't have that conversation without saying the words.
Yeah.
And so I think if I'm being authentic as an educator, I have to be brave enough to say, hey, we're going to talk about this stuff. And the students have to be brave enough to say, can we be a little uncomfortable in order to be real? And so far in my experience, it's been very, very positive.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that, because it always did kind of not vex me, but it was interesting kind of pondering how that would work, knowing what you did or having somewhat of an idea of what you did in where you did it, how that would work. But it's nice to hear that. Something you said, which is very important, is that in institutions of higher learning is where we should be having our youth. It's a great place for youth to be challenged on their thoughts and their ideas and to be pushed in other directions. And if it's not being done there and we're just giving them a softball pitch of whatever they want to hear, then why are they even going? What are we educating them on? We're just giving them, spoon feeding them what makes them feel good. That doesn't give anyone any real world means or any actual education.
I agree. I had a colleague, and I'll just do a shout out. I'm sure she doesn't even remember saying this to me. It was at a luncheon once at the table. I'm not even sure she remembers who I am, but Mimi Marinucci said this to me.
She's a big fan of the show.
Shout out to Mimi Marinucci. So she said something, and this was honestly probably 10 years ago, and it stuck with me. She talked about, we have come from a place of, we arrive at a buffet and we see broccoli and we walk by the broccoli and say, I don't like broccoli. I'm not going to put any broccoli on my plate. That we came from that space and somehow ended up, how dare they put broccoli at the buffet, knowing that I don't like broccoli. And that if we approach, how dare they speak about this thing that offends me? Don't they know that I'm offended? If we approach things that way, it really... I think robs us of real conversations. And I often tell students, it is not my job to make you feel comfortable all the time. And in fact, when we're exposed to broccoli or exposed to things that make us uncomfortable, that's when that's when growth occurs.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's when we feel uncomfortable, we're forced to either say, hey, why am I uncomfortable right now? this doesn't match up with what I believe. Now I'm being forced to articulate why I believe what I believe and why this bothers me. And that looks like growth. Or we realize, hey, actually, this makes me uncomfortable because maybe I'm wrong about this.
Right.
And both of those things to me are growth. So I really try to approach education with real conversations that don't guarantee comfort, but hopefully guarantee that if you buy in, if you agree to be uncomfortable, you can hopefully at the end of the semester know more than you did when you started.
Yeah.
And get better at being exposed to broccoli.
Yeah. Well, yeah, not only, you know, I'll take that analogy a step further. Not only do people say broccoli offends me, but now they're saying, don't they know broccoli offends me? And now they want that person to, that buffet to close and never be a buffet anywhere again.
Yes.
They're
like, let me talk to your manager. Yeah. I would like, to report that there was broccoli here.
Right.
And I think we've really sort of encouraged that sort of response to things.
Yeah.
And it is kind of my personal mission to try to combat that, because I think it's harmful in a million ways.
Yeah, I agree 100%. There's an analogy I always use about astronauts and how when they're in space, you know, there's no gravity in space. There's no friction, pressure. There's nothing pushing against them. So their bones actually atrophy in space. That's why they can only be in space for so long. Then they have to come back and be in these chambers to help redevelop their bone density. And I think that same thing's happening to people, whereas if you don't, you know, have any friction, new thoughts, new ideas, things pressing against you, things that you're working against, and you don't have any gravity or pressure, you just start to atrophy as a person, you know, your mind, your ideas, you spin out of control and start finding things to, you really need things friction to work and work through things and have some adversity.
I think about I don't want to name her, an elderly woman that I know that doesn't have a lot of friction in her life.
Sure.
And has a very limited exposures and environment. And she spends most of the day looking out the window. Why is this person driving down my street? What are they up to? Did they order a new couch?
Yeah.
What color is that couch?
Right.
And it's like, okay, you need to have more going on.
Yeah.
You need to have reasons to express your opinions and clarify your opinions. Otherwise, like you said, you start looking for things that don't really matter.
Yeah.
And I think it's a better place when you spend your days worrying about things that matter and let the other stuff go, you know, pick your battles.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Okay, I have one more question that I want to ask you about, because this is something that has been fascinating me for a while, and I don't know if you can answer it or if you have any thoughts on it, but given your particular field of expertise, I want your opinion on it.
Are you going to show me a rash?
No, yeah, this is, should I see a doctor?
If so, I'm not that kind of doctor.
Yeah. Well, only one way to find out. Yeah. The rise of in the use of sex robots has been coming along quite quickly.
Actually, I would prefer the rash discussion. if we could stay on that line. Mm-hmm. Okay, the rise in sex dolls.
Not even sex dolls, sex robots.
Where
they're
robots.
Actually,
okay.
Actually programmable with personalities and traits. And,
oh, I've dated that guy.
how that affects could affect the sexuality of people in the way our culture goes, and maybe even some of the moral implications of basically creating a thing that doesn't have a choice in the matter.
Yeah.
But you're just programming it to dehuman. I mean, it's not human to begin with, but you're dehumanizing it, and how that may affect your dehumanization of other people sexually.
Yeah.
Too.
I think that's a really great area of inquiry for a lot of different reasons. So I'll do panels where students will get to ask anonymous questions, you know, where they'll text it in so they don't have to. And these kind of questions often come up. Is porn an okay substitution for dating? I don't have time to do this, this, and this. It's too much drama. Is it okay if I just instead turn to porn? Or, you know, in these sort of examples, now that we have more and more human-like substitutions for human relationships, is that okay? Is that harmful? Is it a good substitution for, well, isn't that better than just going out and sleeping around with a bunch of people? And I think some people would use that. I've also heard people, well, especially if we're talking about sexual predators, isn't it safer for somebody to have those sort of connections? Mm-hmm. But what I think from a sociological perspective, something that you're brushing on that's important is what happens when we dehumanize people? You know, is there crossover?
Yeah.
What happens when we lose the need to connect with real people because we can meet these sexual needs without having to buy anybody dinner, without having to deal with the drama of relationships, without having to deal with the vulnerability of having real connections with real people? And I think that we don't even have to be as extreme as sex robots to have that conversation.
Yeah.
So I think maybe the broader question is not necessarily are sex robots good or bad? Is porn good or bad? Is, you know, online dating and things like Tinder, is that good or bad? Is it dehumanizing? I think the broader question is how is it impacting our lives? How is it impacting our ability to connect with real people? If whatever you're watching for porn or for your sex robot or whatever is impacting your ability to connect with real people, then I think it's a problem.
Yeah.
I think if it impacts your relationships and ability to connect, then there are long-term, you know, implications that are negative for that sort of thing. I don't think it's as easy as is it good or bad, but I do see potential for, you know, moving us further away from the ability to have healthy relationships with real people.
Yeah, and there's when you're getting your needs, when you're simplifying your needs, like someone who says, you mentioned, oh, I don't have time for a relationship or there's too much drama, so I just turn to porn. Mm-hmm. Is that good or bad? Like you said, that is a hard question to answer. It's not a simple yes or no. I mean, it's whether it's good or bad. There is definitely some nuance and how often and how it's affecting other things. But I think if they're turning to it as a complete alternative to dating, you know, maybe it's like you kind of have to think about why is dating too much drama for you? Why is, you know, why do you not have the time? And maybe there's other issues that need to be worked on. And that disconnect, as you mentioned, from humans in general and drawing us further apart from actually having human connections. I mean, when you have, you know, we're at a point now where it's not even, you know, sex dolls, they're literally going to be sex robots with personalities,
right?
and fully animatronic and be like people almost, you know, I mean, where you almost will be not be able to tell the difference. That's coming faster than we realize. That is going to be, so
I'm starting to wonder if you're a real person
or if I'm just a sex robot.
It's just recently been going through my mind as I'm watching you talk. I think you bring up something really important there too that I think is important to mention. With porn exposure, and I would imagine with the sort of exposures that you're describing now, when we have an overly romanticized version of anything. So mm-hmm. in porn, you know, there's typically a overly represented body type.
Sure.
A overly represented willingness to engage in certain behaviors. You know, oftentimes there's multiple women and one guy, or oftentimes there are, you know, bodies that are physically enhanced and surgically enhanced. And so when we're exposed to those as being normalized versions of sex and sexuality, what then does that also do with our expectations of ourselves and of the other sex? So if you think, if you grow up learning that, hey, pornography is what sex is supposed to look like, now this is how I'm supposed to perform. These are the things that I'm supposed to be willing to do. This is the way that my body is supposed to look. And I think that can be damaging on a lot of different levels.
Yeah.
I think from a macro level, so that being a micro level, but from a macro level, we also look at things like sex trafficking and drug abuse and other things that might be involved in getting people to perform those acts. So I think it could be harmful in a couple different ways, but also now if we're talking about making a, you know, I think of that weird science, you know, from way back when, where if you're making the perfect person in this robot form, what then does that do to our expectations of real people? You know, if now we can just have this perfect version of this and they don't talk back and they don't ask you to pay for dinner sometimes and they don't, you know, wonder why you're home late. And now how does that cross over to our expectations of other people?
Yeah.
And I think that could potentially be an impact, too, of, again, moving away from real relationships.
Well, it just makes that connection when there's no adversity again. It's so simple. It's like, oh, I just don't date because there's drama. Well, there's no drama with this robot I programmed. So now it's like, are people actually forming relationships? Are we, you know, are people engaging in relationships together, procreating, you know, things like that? I actually read a book a while back about it where this doctor was talking about how he said that he predicted that the first marriage between a man and a robot would be by 2050, that it would be legal to marry the robot. And it's like at that point, you know, it seems crazy, but you start thinking about it. You're like, yeah, that's probably going to happen, you know, in our lifetime.
I would like to watch if the robot said no.
It's just that, yeah, that like so, a different version of The Bachelor, yeah, just a bunch
totally.
Of
you ask and you don't know, but no, actually I'm holding out for, I don't know about that. All I know is that, I do think, and I love your analogy that when we're not called to compromise, when we're not called to listen and engage with other people and be made to think in new and different ways, I think there can be a lot of broad consequences to that.
Yeah.
Some of which we're already seeing, and I think if we moved in that direction, it would follow that we would get more sort of obtuse and more divided.
Yeah, definitely. Well, hopefully we can come together more. 2020 has been a wild year. Although people keep talking about, oh, it'll end, 2020 is almost over. And I'm like, it doesn't reboot January 1st. It could get worse. Like, we don't know what the next year holds for us. Just because the year ends doesn't mean, you know, that I don't think the earth looks at things in our Gregorian calendar.
I think a lot of us have taken things for granted that maybe we're being called to re-examine now.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I have I don't know if I have high hopes. I'm pragmatic, but also I'm hopeful, but realistic. We'll put it that way. So, well, Robin, I appreciate you coming on the show. It was fantastic seeing you and talking to you. Please tell everyone where they can find you, follow you, and where they can find the book.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.
This has been a lot of fun. It's Robin Pickering, and you can get the book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart. I'm sure I'm forgetting someone locally here in Spokane at Auntie's Bookstore. There's also going to be on October 16th a book reading Zoom because of obviously because of the virus, but that is hosted by Auntie's. So you can actually go on the Auntie's website and find the information to get hooked up on that Zoom book reading. And you can follow me on LinkedIn and all kinds of other things. If you go to my Amazon author page, my contact information's on there.
Okay. Well, go follow her, find her, read A Modern Approach to the Birds and the Bees. If you are a parent, you definitely need it. If you're not a parent, you should read it anyway for when you do have kids or just to better educate yourself in any interactions you may have with people too. It couldn't hurt. So, all right, Robin, anything else before we get out of here?
Oh, I think that was great. Thank you so much for letting me come and talk about lots of things.
Absolutely. I look forward to seeing you again. And on your next book, we'll do it again.
Sounds good.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. And as always, go to Dees Comedy / calendar. Check out all the dates on the calendar. Live dates. not in Washington, but Montana, Idaho, as well as come down to Trivia at Spokane Comedy Club every Wednesday and the Social Minute every Monday on the Social Hour Facebook page and YouTube. All right, guys, for the Social Hour, I've been Deese, and for Robin, thank you very much, and we will see you next week.